This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Friday, June the 12th, 2026. As is my custom, we'll start in the world section of today's Monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, first up from the world section, here's a headline, and it reads, "Is India next up in global Gen Z protests? Its, quote, cockroach movement hits the streets. A recent wave of youth protests have shown it's possible to translate online outrage into real-world change. Now, a social media page-turned-political movement in India is trying to rally followers." The data on this article is June the 12th, and the author is Akash Hassan, who is a contributor at the Monitor. The dateline is New Delhi. Anulika Dhawan and several friends slipped out of their dorm rooms in Punjab late last Friday, careful not to tip off any parents that they were leaving. Their families, worried about their safety, might have tried to stop them from making the overnight journey to Delhi, and Ms. Dhawan felt she had to go. The 19-year-old undergraduate student was driven to Jantar Mantar, a historic observatory and famous protest site in central Delhi, by frustration shared by young people across India. Repeated examination scandals, a shortage of jobs, and a growing sense that politicians are not listening. On Saturday, she stood among hundreds of protesters, some wearing cockroach masks and waving placards, demanding accountability from the government. The gathering marked the first major street demonstration by the Cockroach Janta Party, or CJP, a movement that's taken its name from a disparaging comment made by the country's top judge in May about young, unemployed Indians. It has attracted millions of followers online and is now attempting to translate that popularity into real-life political action. Indeed, some have wondered whether India is next up in a wave of Gen Z protests that have led to concrete change and even toppled governments elsewhere in the world. There was a suppressed angst and frustration in the youth of India who are feeling cheated at every stage, says Apoorvanand, an expert in Indian political movements and professor of Hindi at the University of Delhi, who, like many in India, uses a single name. The movement tapped into that. The crowd in Delhi and at a second protest in Pune in western India on Thursday were relatively modest compared with the movement's online following. But with more demonstrations being planned, many Indians are watching to see what the cockroaches can achieve once they find their footing. So far, we have seen an idea emerge, says Apoorvanand. We have to see whether youth are really ready to invest their time and energy. The protests come at a moment of growing anxiety among India's young people. Despite the country's rapid economic growth, unemployment among people ages 15 to 29 remains around 15%, roughly three times the national rate. Competition for secure government jobs has become increasingly intense. Parliamentary data shows that between 2014 and 2022, more than 220 million applications were submitted for central government positions, while fewer than 750,000 candidates were ultimately recommended for appointment. During a Supreme Court hearing in May, Chief Justice of India, Surya Kant, compared unemployed young people to cockroaches and parasites, sparking immediate backlash. CJP founder and recent Boston University graduate Abhijit Dipki was living an ordinary life in the United States, hunting for jobs in public relations when he heard the comments. "What if all cockroaches came together?" he wrote on X. Chief Justice Kant later said his remarks had been misunderstood and were directed at people using fake qualifications to enter professions such as law and journalism, not unemployed youth broadly. Nevertheless, Mr. Dipke's question struck a nerve. As his ex-post gained traction and online buzz around the cockroach label intensified, Mr. Dipke launched the Cockroach Janta Party, Janta means the people in Hindi, complete with a website, social media accounts, and a tongue-in-cheek slogan, Voice of the Lazy and Unemployed. The name was an obvious play on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, but beneath the humor was a serious message. For many young Indians struggling to find stable jobs after years of studying for competitive exams, it felt like recognition. Within weeks, the movement's Instagram account attracted more than 22 million followers, surpassing those of both the BJP and the opposition Congress Party. I was surprised by the support, says Mr. Dipke, who returned to India last weekend to take the campaign to the streets. It was eye-opening, he said. Ms. Dhawan cheered along as Mr. Dipke took aim at India's education system on Saturday at the CJP's inaugural rally. Microphone in hand, standing under a blazing sun, he demanded the education minister's resignation and called for accountability for repeated university exam scandals, which have become a potent symbol of broader anxieties about education, fairness, and opportunities in India. Just last month, authorities canceled the highly competitive National Medical Entrance Exam, which is taken by more than 2 million students annually, including Ms. Dhawan, last year, after test questions were allegedly leaked. The whole process has become a nightmare for students, said Ms. Dhawan, who had also watched her highly educated siblings struggle to find jobs after graduating. Our education system is failing us, she said. Mr. Dipke said the CJP's small core team is busy planning future protests and crafting a formal proposal for fixing India's education system, an issue many feel India's politicians have neglected. People are not going to get jobs out of Hindu-Muslim politics, he says, referring to the communal divisions Mr. Modi's Hindu nationalist government has been accused of exploiting. Exams will not be fixed by that. The government's priorities have to change. The emergence of the CJP has prompted comparisons with youth-led movements elsewhere in South Asia. In neighboring Bangladesh and Nepal, for example, frustration over jobs and corruption fueled protests, which initially took shape online before spilling into the streets. In both cases, protesters challenged the political establishment and contributed to major leadership changes in 2024 and 2025, respectively. But the upheaval came at a cost. In Bangladesh, hundreds were killed during months of anti-government protests that eventually forced Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to flee the country, while in Nepal, demonstrators stormed and in some cases burned key government buildings. Mr. Dipke rejects those parallels, arguing that the CJP movement is committed to peaceful constitutional protest. We have demonstrated that we will be peaceful, he said during a news conference on Monday. In the future, there will be even bigger demonstrations, and they will be peaceful. Thursday's demonstration in Pune reportedly drew hundreds of people. Another protest is scheduled for today in Lucknow in northern India. For Apoorvanand, however, the important question is not whether the CJP resembles other youth-led movements, but whether it can unite a generation that remains deeply fragmented by the dynamics of class, caste, and religion. Student protests over jobs, recruitment exams, and educational policy have erupted across India in recent years, he notes. What has often been missing is a common platform capable of stitching those grievances together. That's where the CJP could really make a difference. The frustration is building, he said, but we are yet to see the breaking point. After this week's protests, Ms. Dhawan is feeling optimistic. It feels like we are finally getting somewhere in an atmosphere where critical voices are increasingly labeled as disruptors or anti-nationals, she says. This new movement has the potential to bring us together and put pressure on the system. If the CJP can continue to grow its coalition, and if its followers embrace a stubbornly resilient cockroach mentality, this once satirical endeavor might succeed in achieving real political change. And once again, this particular article was written by Akash Hassan, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor. This one reads, Two-tier policing? What is it and why is it dividing Britain? Despite complaints about two-tiered policing in Britain, experts say minorities don't receive favorable treatment from cops. So why does the accusation persist? The date on this article is June the 11th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Berlin. Shocking images from a recently released police body camera video have once again plunged Britain into a wrenching debate that is only gaining force. Do British police go easier on migrant communities and liberal causes? Critics on the far right point to several examples of what they call a double standard of two-tier policing. The most incendiary allegation is that police were loath to investigate ethnically South Asian grooming gangs, which sexually abused young white girls from the mid-1990s to the 2010s, for concern of being thought culturally insensitive. But at the core of two-tier policing is the complaint that protests against migration are dealt with more harshly than protests for Palestinians or Black Lives Matter. These accusations have exploded with the release of police footage in Southampton last week. It showed a young white man, Henry Nowak, being handcuffed on suspicion of racist abuse, even though he had been stabbed by his accuser, a British man of South Asian descent. He died within minutes. Another brazen knife attack in Belfast, in Northern Ireland this week, and subsequent riots further fueled the charged atmosphere around the issue in the United Kingdom. Despite these incidents, however, the data presents an opposite picture. It suggests that minorities and migrant communities are much more likely to experience police violence or be subject to search by authorities than white Britons. Yet at a moment when bonds of societal trust are fraying, the debate of two-tier policing goes to something more than just facts, say criminologists and police experts. It speaks to a country divided about how to move forward and a police force increasingly caught in the middle. We have partly become a more divisive society. It's a more volatile situation, says Peter Squires, a criminologist at the University of Brighton. The police on the front line are out on a limb. Dr. Squires and others are quick to dismiss the idea of two-tier policing in any formal sense. To most criminologists, it is other nonsense, he says. It's largely a political narrative. Like many of the examples cited, the tragic death of Mr. Nowak was a case of bad policing, not any larger agenda, others add. In the end, they note, the system corrected itself and found the correct malfactor. Mr. Nowak's attacker was arrested and sentenced to a minimum of 21 years in prison. There are poor coincidences that make it appear it is part of a big conspiracy when it is not, says Ian Widget, a former police officer in London and Manchester, who now writes for Policing Insight, a website that analyzes policing trends. But there's no question that police in Britain are in a delicate situation. An investigation into the 1993 death of Stephen Lawrence, who was black, revealed entrenched institutional racism. The 30 years since have been defined by comprehensive reform. Yet now, the rise of a strong anti-migration movement means many of those new lessons are seen as, quote, woke. This puts policing itself at the center of the political storm. If you want an issue that highlights all the divisions in society, it's policing, Mr. Widget says. That makes policing harder. Mr. Widget and others say different protests are policed differently because of their character, not their political agenda. Some of the anti-migration protests involve young men lighting fires or throwing bricks at mosques, he notes. Discretion is at the heart of policing. You're focused on criminality. Where are the problems? Who is causing the problems, he said. You realize you do have to treat people differently. This discretion was always based on trust. Indeed, the iconic image of the unarmed British bobby was a product of this trust. British policing has always been about policing by consent of the people, says Dr. Squires. But with so much division, he adds, consent is pretty hard to find these days. For his part, Solat Chowdhury says he has great sympathy with people who claim two-tier policing exists. Mr. Chowdhury was a police officer before later going on to found the National Center for Diversity. He knows the data shows that minorities face disproportionate rates of police violence, and as a police officer, he had colleagues make racist comments to him directly. But he also knows that many who are talking about two-tier policing have had their own bad experiences with police. They've not been treated well enough, he says. The working class community has been dumped on for generations. The real two-tier policing is based on class, not race, he says. If we need to solve this problem, we have to address why white working classes are living like this. He points to the grooming gangs as an example. The problem was not that the predators were from a migrant community. It was that the police did not think those girls were worthy. Others agree. The victims were people who are badly served by policing and the criminal justice system, says Dr. Squires. Poor, white, generally overlooked people living in rough areas. Police have generally not served their interests very well. All sorts of predatory behaviors have become normalized. The portrait of British policing today is of a system in flux, pulled between decades of reforms and new political pressures, all while every move is scrutinized. Amid such uncertainty, both sides can find examples and missteps to build a narrative, even if the truth is messier, says Mr. Widget. What reason do you want to believe? The reality is that both exist side by side. And once again, this particular article was by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Continuing on in the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Caught between war and peace, Iranians live in limbo. The world has watched as President Donald Trump vacillates between promises that peace is near in Iran and threats of renewed war. No one bears the cost of that uncertainty more than Iranians. The date on this article is June the 11th. It is by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is London. Before the war, Keshem Island in the Strait of Hormuz was an Iranian holiday destination that offered boutique hotels, quaint cafes, and the embrace of a slower, disconnected island lifestyle. Suddenly, we are living on the front line, says one Keshem guesthouse owner in a text message exchange who could not be named for his security as he prepared to leave the island Thursday after 9 years. It had been another night of blasts and the buzz of drones and fighter jets. It's been a nightmare. We have U.S. or Israeli attacks almost every day, he said. U.S. strikes on Iran early Wednesday and Thursday, which U.S. Central Command portrayed as self-defense for Iran's earlier downing of a U.S. Apache attack helicopter, included targets on Keshem, which overlooks the narrow Strait of Hormuz, through which one-fifth of global energy supplies pass. The United States justified the second night of strikes, saying Iran was taking too long to accept a truce deal on American terms. If we need to negotiate with bombs, we'll negotiate with bombs, says Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. President Donald Trump said Iran would be hit very hard for a third night in a social media post Thursday. The U.S. would seize Karg Island and other oil infrastructure points and assume total control of their oil and gas markets, he wrote in the not-too-distant future. Iran responded both nights by launching missiles and drones at American bases in Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain. On early Thursday, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps closed the strait and declared that any moving vessel would be attacked. Iran says the U.S. strikes have rendered the April ceasefire effectively meaningless and warned of dangerous consequences. The war, launched jointly against Iran in late February by the U.S. and Israel, marked by thousands of airstrikes and missile exchanges and now battles over control of the straits, has turned Qassam into a battleground. The disruption of its once-renowned tranquility now reflects the broader turmoil and contested consequences of conflict for Iranians. The island has become unrecognizable, says the guesthouse owner, with 60 or so cafes and homestays closed. Two of his friends were killed weeks into the war while doing maintenance on their boats. Residents erased contents on their mobile phones to avoid scrutiny at numerous security checkpoints. "You know, what's killing us is not the missiles or drones or Shiite clerical mullahs or Trump," says the Qassam resident, who loaded his vehicle and another truck for his exodus from the island Thursday. "Not having a vision is the most lethal weapon." The Islamic Republic portrays the result so far as victory over far more capable enemies than sought to topple the regime and destroy its strategic capabilities. The regime has instead survived and has even found ways to exercise new global economic leverage. But Iranian citizens say the country's underlying problems remain unsolved. After years of economic hardship, exacerbated by Western sanctions over its nuclear program and a deadly government crackdown on anti-regime protests earlier this year that left thousands dead, many say the war has only deepened a sense of exhaustion and despair. Vacillating threats, including one to send Iran back to the Stone Age and unrealized diplomatic promises from Mr. Trump, have added to their uncertainty. On Wednesday, just hours after predicting a truce deal within days, Mr. Trump claimed on social media, quote, "They have been completely defeated. Iran is all talk and no action. The bully of the Middle East is dead," end quote. Amid counter threats from Iran's surviving leadership, many Iranians say the term victory is hard to envision as anything more than avoiding defeat. "No war has an ideal outcome. The choices are limited to bad and worse," says a middle-aged electronics engineer and father of two in Tehran, contacted by phone, who gave the name Beynam. He says he lost a relative in an Israeli airstrike. "About outcome is the end of the war with the current status quo, and a worse outcome is the resumption of the war with more losses and casualties," he says. "In any case, it will not be considered a victory. Both the regime and Iranian civil society are weaker than they were 3 months ago." Despite damage to industrial and economic infrastructure and rising inflation, Beynam says the regime has strengthened its grip against a common enemy. "In the balance between civil society and the ruling regime, the balance has definitely shifted in favor of the regime," he says. "That change is reflected by top Iranian officials. They have vowed to strike back against further U.S. and Israeli strikes, control shipping in the strait, and maintain Iran's nuclear and missile programs. They have also linked an Israeli ceasefire in Lebanon, the stronghold of Iran's embattled Hezbollah ally, to any broader deal with the U.S. There is definitely a rally around the homeland. I wouldn't say rally around the flag," says Sina Tusi, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington. With the war definitely for the regime and supporters of the regime, this is very much a moment of confidence, maybe overconfidence, like, what else is going to threaten us? They can't overthrow us. They can't beat us through military means. So they are feeling strongly situated, says Mr. Tusi. That, he says, has given some ordinary people a sense of pride, but that will translate into increased regime support only if people feel the benefits of a stabler economy. For the longest time, when you talk to ordinary people, they said, okay, we're picking this battle with America and Israel, and we're getting poorer as a result of it, Mr. Tusi says. People still need to see the dividends of it. Throughout much of the conflict, authorities shut down the internet and phone services, effectively disconnecting Iranians from the outside world. As that blockage eased in late May, Iranians vented their frustration on social media. One Iranian gave an a one when asked to rate quality of life on a scale of 1 to 10. Since the 8 January crackdown, everything has been downhill. For a month, all we did was weep and suffer in anguish. Before we had even recovered from that scar, came the internet shutdowns and the war, the Iranian posted on social media X, so the social media platform X. The fear and anxiety of living through a war on top of losing access to the internet were utterly maddening. And now the inflation and uncertainty are trampling whatever has remained of our existence. Such sentiments resonate with a Tehran homemaker who no longer wears a head covering hijab as officially required. She holds a master's degree in Persian literature, has no children, and gave the name Roya. I was really hoping that this war would lead to a serious weakening of the Islamic Republic. That's why it's so difficult for me to talk about a, quote, victory for the government, she says. The best outcome it achieved was simply surviving the crisis. But staying in power alone cannot really be described as a victory, said Roya. I have a great deal of respect for the people of Iran. Under extremely difficult circumstances, they showed remarkable resilience and endurance, she says. But any government policy should ultimately be judged by its impact on people's lives. If the end result does not improve people's situations, I don't see it as something for the state to be proud of. Episodes of protest in recent years, adds Roya, demonstrate the widespread scale of popular anger, but also show that change in Iran is a difficult long-term process. I have not lost hope, not because I think major changes will happen tomorrow, but because the underlying problems that have fueled public dissatisfaction are still right there, she says. And a note here that an Iranian researcher contributed to this report, which was written by Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Still in the world section of today's Monitor, here's something on a little bit of a lighter note. The headline reads, A Mexican Wave, Soccer Mania Swells as World Cup Opens. Mexico may have its challenges, but when it comes to being a host for the World Cup, it has its North American co-host beat. The date on this article is June the 11th. It is by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor, and the dateline is Mexico City. It's 8 a.m. on a Saturday in Mexico City, but the main thoroughfare, Paseo de la Reforma, is already bursting with activity. A long line, about 20 people wide, crawls down a cordoned-off section of the avenue. On the sidelines, a small group dance Zumba while bouncing soccer balls to the beat. Several women gather near a stone bench to change into high heels and pull on hoop skirts under their floral ribbon-adorned traditional dance dresses. And a scrum of larger-than-life puppets called mojigangas, decked out in Mexico's national soccer jersey, sway above the crowd. And the party is only getting started. By late morning, tens of thousands of people are here, gathering to try to set a new Guinness World Record for the largest ola, or wave, outside of a stadium. In most of the world, except the United States, the synchronized movement, in which crowds of people stand up, throw their arms in the air, and then sit back down, is known as the Mexican Wave. It wasn't invented here, but was popularized at Mexico's 1986 World Cup, reaching far-flung soccer fans in Europe, Asia, and Africa watching those matches on television. The fact that most people associate the wave with Mexico is in part a reflection of the country's hosting prowess. This year's 104 World Cup matches will be played across Canada, the United States, and Mexico, group hosts for the tournament. Often framed as the junior partner in North American endeavors, Mexico has its share of challenges. But it is the real expert when it comes to hosting the world's most viewed sporting event. It hosted two World Cup tournaments before the U.S. ever had a chance, and this year will be Canada's first. On June 11th, the tournament kicks off with an inaugural match between Mexico and South Africa. I will never forget seeing the wave for the first time in 86, says Esteban Mejia, soaking up the morning excitement with his green jersey-clad dog, Boo. He says he isn't surprised the wave is associated with Mexico because history tells the truth. Mexicans are phenomenal World Cup hosts. Across the city, there are happenings like the June 6th wave, pulling fans into the World Cup action, even if they can't attend one of the pricey games. Art and cultural exhibitions are open in all corners of the capital, which says it has the most museums per capita in the world. Mexico City is also literally turning green as the rainy season gets started and residents start donning their national team swag to work and school. What is going on today? A towering Dutchman asked a woman selling Mexican flags at the wave event. She smiles, shrugs, and tells him in Spanish that she's selling two tricolor national flags for the price of one. Bas van Doorn traveled to Mexico in early June with friends, hoping to find tickets to the opening match. "We decided to come here for the vibe," he says, referring to their decision to choose Mexico instead of one of the other two host nations. "In Holland, we love the World Cup, but we're just more sober people. We would never have something like this," he says, motioning to the giant crowd of wave enthusiasts. "A typical wave moves at a speed of about 40 feet per second and requires about 25 people to set one off, according to a 2002 study published in the scientific journal Nature. Its origin story is still debated, but the now global phenomenon likely began in the early 1980s at sporting events in the United States." Across town, an exhibit of ephemera from past World Cups is on display at a show called The City That Never Stopped Playing. It celebrates all four of Mexico City's mega soccer events. Mexico also hosted a major women's tournament that was never endorsed by FIFA in 1971, largely through trinkets and treasures sourced from average citizens. "Each one of these major tournaments left a fingerprint on the city," says show curator Alejandra de la Mora. For its first World Cup in 1970, Mexico had a population of 48 million people. Today, the population is closer to 133 million. And the capital had just inaugurated its first metro line the year prior. Color television sets were beginning to show up in living rooms here, and the city had recently opened its world-famous Estadio Azteca. Fans were collecting Juanito dolls, a cherubic player wearing a Mexico uniform and an oversized yellow sombrero. In 1986, Mexico was hosting in the aftermath of one of the most destructive earthquakes in its history. There have always been problems, right? But that's the magic of soccer, because it seeps through the cracks and touches everything, and you start to feel something very different, says Ms. De La Mora. "I'm convinced that when the first match starts, that feeling of the goodness of humanity will be palpable and will forget everything else. The city will be transformed into this city that knows how to welcome, that knows how to enjoy, and that knows how to host." Maria Berta Orduna Molina, who played center back on the 1971 Women's World Cup team, known as the Pioneers, says that back then, soccer in the stadiums were reserved just for the guys. Her team still holds the Guinness World Record for the largest attendance at a women's sporting event. Their final match against Denmark attracted 110,000 fans, filling Estadio Azteca to its capacity at the time. Ms. Orduna and several of her former teammates came out to try and clinch their second world record at the Wave event on June 6th. "I can see how much things have changed in the world of soccer and fandom since the 1970s, she says. "Just look at all the girls and women here. The World Cup is now for everyone." But not everyone in Mexico is pumped about this year's tournament. Many call attention to serious challenges that the World Cup host faces, such as the fact that there are more than 130,000 people missing in Mexico, or that some 90% of crimes are never reported to the authorities here. On top of that, a teachers' union has been on strike for higher wages and a pension law reversal. And then the predictable headaches that always come with this sort of event: road closures, last-minute construction, and standstill traffic across the megacity. Sandra Bernal, standing on the sidelines as people practiced the wave each time a woman on stage called out Es la Ola, says she had plenty of worries about the country, from violent crime to the growing cost of living, to politicians she doesn't feel serve her. But I don't know, she says, of the criticism she has heard and seen about Mexico hosting. Maybe that's the point of all this, a few weeks to forget about our problems. And again, this particular article was by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up a few headlines. Our first headline reads, Threatening War, Predicting Peace. Are Trump's comments part of a strategy? As the U.S.-Israel war with Iran has dragged on far longer than President Donald Trump perhaps anticipated, he has alternately predicted an imminent peace deal and threatened punishing attacks. Is this calculated or a sign he has lost control of the conflict? The date on this article is June the 10th. It is by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. So, is a peace deal with Iran just around the corner, or is President Donald Trump on the verge of restarting the war? Given his statements of just the past few days, it's hard to say. On Monday, Mr. Trump struck a familiar chord, telling reporters that negotiations to end the war were in their final throes and that a deal could be reached within days. Then Monday night, an Iranian Shahed drone downed a U.S. Apache helicopter near the Strait of Hormuz. The two aviators were rescued by an American sea drone, but Mr. Trump promised retaliatory strikes, which were indeed carried out on Tuesday. More ominous still, early Wednesday, the president took to Truth Social to declare that the Iranians have taken too long to negotiate a deal that would be great for them. Now they will have to pay the price. Then, speaking to reporters at the Oval Office later in the morning, he said, quote, "We hit them hard yesterday and will be hitting them hard again today," before adding he is still hoping for a deal. The renewed hostilities and threatening language amid a shaky ceasefire might be expected to put off at least the rosy rhetoric of an imminent peace agreement. But then again, maybe not. Over recent weeks, Mr. Trump has claimed dozens of times in various settings, chatting with reporters, speaking to supporters, and in late-night social media posts, that peace talks were making incredible or very rapid progress. An amazing deal was just around the corner, he has predicted, in 2 or 3 days, or a few days, or next week. It's a tune Mr. Trump has sung repeatedly over recent weeks as the ceasefire has smoldered, flared up between Iran and Israel. Flare-ups between Iran and Israel have threatened escalation, and public opinion has further soured on a war the president launched alongside Israel in February. After months of the same, Mr. Trump's style of "we're almost there, we're so close" diplomacy raises questions among some analysts as to whether there is some strategy behind the approach. Are the pronouncements the mark of an optimistic leader whose preference is for quick action and short time frames? Or do they compensate for a reality in which Mr. Trump is not in control of a conflict that is dragging on substantially longer than he first envisioned? So much is shaped by this president's short-term desires, what he wants to see happen quickly, and how he wants others to see the situation, says Behnam Ben Taleblu, senior director of the Iran program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. This may be the president cheerleading, but I do think there is a semblance of strategy to what he's saying, he adds. He wants to inject some optimism into the idea that the talks are going somewhere, he says, but he's also blunting the impact of a more skeptical media and more skeptical markets about the course of this war and the prospect of these talks. Indeed, markets fell Wednesday in response to Mr. Trump's suggestion that talks with Iran might have failed. For some analysts, what might be emerging is an indefinite period of talks proceeding even as tit-for-tat military action occasionally flares, as bitter enemies Iran and Israel both test the limits of military operations within a shaky ceasefire. It may be too soon to look at what's going on as normal in the Middle East, Mr. Taliblu says, but I do think we've entered what might end up as an extended period of shoot and talk at the same time. Still, what some see as Mr. Trump's underlying desire to get a deal and move on from what has been for him a disastrous war might yet prompt an agreement that stops the shooting. That is a worrisome scenario for some Trump critics. Donald Trump clearly wants an agreement allowing him to declare victory and move on from the conflict. But the risk for U.S. national security, however, are potentially enormous, comments former Trump national security advisor John Bolton, a noted Iran hawk, in a column Wednesday in Independent Arabia. He writes that the president's zeal for a deal risks leaving Iran with too much leverage in the region and with big wins, especially financial, in exchange for strict limits on its nuclear program. Mr. Taliblu said that even though he sees a method to the president's upbeat pronouncements, he also draws a line at some, he says, have gone too far. Noting that Mr. Trump last week said he would be honored to meet with Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Mojtabi Khamenei, if a deal can be reached, Mr. Taliblu says such cheery comments are tone-deaf and extremely unwise. This is essentially the same Iranian leadership that by some counts killed tens of thousands of its own citizens in anti-protest crackdowns in January, he says, adding that at the outset of the war, Mr. Trump invoked the memory of those Iranians killed by the state. This kind of remark is putting him into the same unappealing place that President Barack Obama was in and for which Trump criticized him in 2009 for not supporting the Iranian people, Mr. Taliblu said. Whether it's a deal with Iran or renewed war that is very close remains uncertain. But Vice President J.D. Vance appears to have jumped onto the president's deal very close bandwagon. In an interview with CBS News taped Tuesday for airing later in the week, Mr. Vance says the U.S. is, quote, very close to achieving a deal that both opens the vital Strait of Hormuz and assures that Iran won't have a nuclear weapon far beyond Mr. Trump's presidency. Quipping, quote, we've still got some wood to chop, end quote, the vice president said he was certain there would be a deal before November's midterm elections. And again, this particular article is by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline in today's USA section of The Monitor, still focused on the situation in the Middle East. This headline reads, Troop Rescue Near Iran Points to Rising Use of Sea Drones in Combat. The unmanned boat that helped rescue an Apache helicopter crew Monday night was the equivalent of a seaborne pickup truck. The U.S. has urgent mission needs for such autonomous Navy vessels, lawmakers are saying. The date on this article is June the 10th. It is by Anna Mulring-Grobe, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The dramatic rescue of two downed Apache helicopter pilots this week by an unmanned U.S. military boat promises to add to an already significant demand for seafaring drones throughout the U.S. Navy. Dozens are already under development, including everything from small robotic speedboats to the Orca, a large submarine without a human crew, capable of disappearing underwater on mission for months at a time, according to the Pentagon. Just last week, U.S. lawmakers told the Defense Department to speed up its current use of unmanned surface vessels, as they are known in Pentagon parlance. They also asked for more details about the sorts of missions that these drones can help the Navy do. A real-life answer to that question arrived this week in the Strait of Hormuz amid the Iran conflict. The drone that helped the U.S. military rescue the Army helicopter crew on Monday night was a Corsair unmanned surface vessel, a sort of robotic ocean-going truck operated by the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet Task Force 59, according to U.S. Central Command, which runs Pentagon operations in the Middle East. American service members at U.S. bases around the world have urgent mission needs for such drones, lawmakers warned in the 2027 draft defense bill approved by the House Armed Services Committee last week. The key is to make sure the drones, which have also been plagued with software glitches and crashes, can operate when their navigation systems are being jammed and communications with crewed ships are cut off, the committee noted. Task Force 59 began using Corsairs in the Middle East in late March, named for the Sea Raiders given permission by governments to attack enemy shipping from the 1500s to the early 1800s. The Corsair was called into action for the rescue mission this week because of proximity and capability factors, according to a Central Command spokesperson. The drone picked up the two aviators within 2 hours of their crash and took them to a location where they could be airlifted to safety by helicopter. The crash of their Apache might have been caused by a collision with an Iranian drone, according to news reports. Central Command last week warned of Iranian drones operating over the Strait of Hormuz. The Navy launched a special group within Task Force 59 in early 2024 to bolster marine security across the Middle East, according to a January 16, 2024 statement, and soon began using fast robotic speedboats such as the T-38 Devil Ray as well. A 38-foot vessel with no cockpit or crew, the Devil Ray is packed with sensors, communication gear, and weapons designed to advance lethality at sea, the statement said. As the Navy's first sea drone and artificial intelligence task force established in 2021, Task Force 59 has since tested dozens of drones. It often operates as a sort of technology startup embedded inside the Navy's Fifth Fleet headquarters in Bahrain. The Navy's drone development programs have run into challenges, including struggles with the salt corrosion, barnacles, extreme heat, and heavy seas that can keep vessels from operating reliably in the ocean. As with self-driving cars, other perils involve avoiding collisions in, for example, crowded shipping lanes. At a U.S. Navy showcase test attended by the media last August in California, while officers scrambled to fix a software malfunction in one drone boat, another unmanned vessel crashed into it, Reuters reported at the time. The Navy ultimately hopes to turn groups of hand-picked troops into pioneers in seafaring drones, as it has done with Task Force 59, its Commodore, Captain Colin Corridon, said in 2024. Such trust and experience with robots is ultimately developing the next generation of sailors, he added, to spearhead the hybrid fleet of the future. And once again, this particular article was by Anna Mulring-Grobe, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Now we're going to move on to a new section in the Monitor called Perspectives. And our first headline from there reads, "On this D-Day anniversary, the Trump administration boosts Europe's far right." The Trump administration and the United States' closest allies in Europe are moving further away from the shared democratic values that once cemented that relationship. The date on this article is June the 10th. It is by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at the Monitor, and the dateline is London. The mood at the remembrance ceremony was somber. On ground hallowed by the bravery of tens of thousands of American and Allied troops who surged onto the narrow stretch of sand just a few hundred yards away to finally liberate Europe from Adolf Hitler. But this year's commemoration of the June 1944 D-Day landings at the Normandy American Cemetery overlooking Omaha Beach in northwest France played out unlike any before it. In a departure from speakers' traditional emphasis on the abiding importance of the shared values of the liberating nations and of the post-war transatlantic security alliance, NATO, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth delivered a strikingly different political message. He rebuked European governments for failing to crack down on immigration from the Middle East and Africa, quote, and a, quote, invasion, as Mr. Hegseth put it, that he likened to the Allies' D-Day thrusts against the Nazis. The timing of his remarks gave them added impact. They came ahead of NATO's annual summit early next month to be hosted by Turkey and on top of already growing strains within the alliance. U.S. President Donald Trump has recently revived talks of quitting NATO altogether, angered by the European allies' unwillingness to join his war against Iran. The main concern for European partners remains Russia's war on Ukraine. while they've been ramping up their defense spending to compensate for Mr. Trump's reduction of U.S. support for Kyiv, they're still not in a position to do without America's linchpin NATO role. And even if Mr. Trump stops short of a formal withdrawal, European confidence in America's support has been inexorably waning. A new opinion poll this week conducted across 15 European countries found an average of only 11% of respondents considered the U.S. to be an ally. That was down from around 25% in late 2024 and 16% late last year. Half of those surveyed did view Washington as a necessary partner, but most said that they were no longer confident America would come to their country's defense if they were under attack. Yet Mr. Hegseth's speech tapped into an even deeper worry among European leaders about U.S. policy. It's not just a concern about a potentially loosened American security commitment and their capability to provide sufficient help to Ukraine on their own. It's that the Trump administration no longer feels a political kinship or a sense of shared values with America's post-World War II democratic partners, and that it sees its true allies as the far-right anti-immigration parties rising in the polls in a number of European countries. Mr. Hegseth's speech followed another recent message about European immigration policy from Vice President J.D. Vance in response to controversy surrounding video cam footage of the police responding to a fatal knife assault on a teenager in Britain. Though the attacker was a British man of Punjabi descent, Mr. Vance blamed the attack on a failure by European elites to oppose mass invasion of migrants. UK officials criticized the vice president's intervention, but they see little prospect he will step back from his public support for anti-immigration populist parties in Britain or elsewhere in Europe. That's a particular concern for Britain's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. Not only is he facing a possible leadership challenge from within his own Labour Party, this week he was also having to defuse public unrest in Northern Ireland over an attempted beheading on Monday in Belfast, not by a locally born man, but by an asylum seeker from Sudan. On both security and immigration, European leaders still hope they'll be able to find some common ground with the Trump administration. Not only are they boosting their own defense spending, they've tightened immigration controls over the past few years, and the number of migrants arriving in European countries are far lower than their peak level of a decade ago. Still, the Trump administration's view towards Europe has been hardening in recent months. In a recent national security strategy released last December, the White House warned that many European countries were facing the stark prospect of civilizational erasure as a result of the arrival of non-European immigrants. It said that the U.S. would cultivate patriotic European political parties resisting immigration. A couple of weeks ago, in remarks at a security conference in Asia, Mr. Hegseth accused European allies of having thrown open their borders and hollowed out their militaries. Europe and NATO have some big decisions to make, he declared. The particulars of Mr. Hegseth's vision for America's closest allies were left unclear. He told the D-Day audience that this would have to go beyond empty slogans, lavish summits, or communiques. But the sea change in Washington's approach to Europe is perhaps best underscored by Mr. Hegseth's own speech at last year's D-Day commemoration in France. Those remarks were much more in keeping with the message from other American political figure speeches on the venerated anniversary of the Allied landings. Without the sacrifice of American, French, British, and other Allied powers, we would not have the free world, he said a year ago. We remember the losses, we celebrate the victories. We rededicate ourselves to the fight for liberty, security, and peace. And again, this particular article was by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor. And with that, we're going to move on now to the editorial section of The Monitor and see what we can find there. So, our first headline reads, NBA Finals. A win for us all. Two talented teams are vying for the 2026 basketball championship. Their athletic skills are impressive. Their examples of decency, determination, and care for others are inspiring. The date on this particular article is June 11th, and it is indeed a commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. Even if you can't tell a layup from a laces drive, it's unlikely you've escaped the buzz and anticipation around two major sporting events this week: the championship series of the National Basketball Association and the opening matches of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Right now, it's fair to say that American sports fans are less focused on the beautiful game and more intent on the matchup between the New York Knicks and the San Antonio Spurs. Devoted fans, as well as casual observers, have been impressed by the athleticism and on-court skills of players from both teams. But throughout the season, they've also been touched by something more: the consistent qualities of character that the players express, such as unity, determination, humility, and care for others. The Knicks, for example, do not fit the caricature of New Yorkers as self-obsessed, grasping, indifferent, The Economist observes. Instead, they are being celebrated for some less recognized qualities of New Yorkers: decency, playfulness, and generosity towards each other. In the Big Apple, thousands of residents and visitors have congregated around big screens in pubs, parks, and streets for community watch parties. Many shared with the media their sense of joy and inclusion at these events. "Everyone is just happy. There's so much love," in the words of one. It feels like the transformation of the world's greatest city into the world's greatest small town, Mayor Zoran Mamdani reported to The Athletic. "We are all thinking about the same thing, a longed-for championship for the Knicks, who last won in 1973. The series heads to San Antonio for Game 5 on Saturday, with the Knicks leading 3-1. Whatever the outcome, that city's 1.5 million residents might also enjoy a similar small-town sense of community, spirit, and cohesion. That's because both teams express uplifting behaviors and attitudes, according to Jeremy Suri, a basketball fan and professor of politics at the University of Texas, Austin. In a recent Substack post, quote, "The Knicks and Spurs show us a better America," Dr. Suri wrote that the athletes show they care about something larger than themselves. "At a time when many Americans feel socially disconnected and cynical," he continued, "the players are needed role models, young men with purpose, with healthy relationships, with belief in themselves and others." Of course, these highly paid professional athletes are also highly competitive. They play to win. So things might get heated on court with some trash talk and fouls. Still, whether through charitable work, New York's Jalen Brunson, a proclivity for quiet introspection, San Antonio's Victor Wembanyama, or religious observance, New York's Carl Anthony Towns, they also teach fans about wins beyond the scoreboard. At this point, it seems right to cheer, "Go Knicks, go Spurs." And that, again, was a commentary from the Monitor's editorial board. With that, we have run out of time for today, and this being Friday this week. I always appreciate you spending some time with me, listening to the variety of articles that the Christian Science Monitor offers. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful. And I'll be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor next week. Thank you for listening.